James 1:22 through 1:27, the seventh talk in a series on James, was presented by Ron Julian on February 5, 2006, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, we're continuing on in James. Our passage in James today is really very closely related to the passage we were looking at last week. We really stopped in the middle of James' thought last week, so we're continuing on with that thought. James has been exploring the theme of God testing our faith through trials. In these trials, we are called upon to persevere in our faith and live out what we say we believe. Through this process, the reality of our faith is seen in our lives, and we grow in maturity and wisdom. So this is the theme, really, of the letter, and this is what James started to talk about. This idea that we are going to face those situations in life that call upon us to live as believers. And that will mature our faith, we will learn through the process, and we will actually see that that inner faith actually has a reality that comes out in our lives. Along the way, he has just responded to a theoretical critic who complains that if this were really true, then God is trying to tempt us, to trip us up and make us sin. And James gave what I see as a three-part answer. First of all, the power of temptation comes from my own evil desires. It is not that I am an innocent person being seduced by a God who's trying to make me sin, but rather, in fact, the draw, the tug that I feel in temptation is coming from my side of things. Secondly, not only is God not trying to make us sin, God is the source of every perfect gift. There's no place else to go to find the blessing that I need in life. And in fact, has shown this most clearly by reaching out to us through the gospel to save us from our sinful selves. So, therefore, he says, we should not respond with suspicion and complaint. We should listen carefully to the gospel and receive its teaching because it will save our souls. James refers to the gospel as the word of truth and the implanted word. But I argued last week that that language, the word of truth, the implanted word, what he means when he says that, that's the message that can save us, that is the gospel. He never uses the word gospel, but that's what we're talking about, basically. In our passage today, he has more to say about how we should respond to this word. So I'm reading in, I think it's verse 22, I didn't write it down, of chapter 1. But be doers of the word, and not merely hearers who delude themselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word, and not a doer, he is like a man who looks in a mirror at the face he was born with. For he looks at himself, and walks away, and immediately forgets what he is like. But one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and remains, not having become a forgetful hearer, but one who does a work, this man shall be blessed in what he does. If anyone thinks himself to be religious, and yet does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. This is pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father, to visit orphans and widows in their time of trouble, and to keep oneself unstained by the world. Okay, so let's go through this and see what we've got. Various little issues to talk about here. He says, having talked about how we should receive the word implanted, which is able to save our souls, he now says about that word, but be doers of the word, and not merely hearers who delude themselves. So to be someone who receives this word of truth, you have to do more than just hear it, you have to do it. Here we see one of the major themes of James' letter, And one of the major issues that Christian theology has struggled with over the centuries, the idea that faith in the gospel calls upon us to do something, that there is some sort of a response called upon from us. Our main task in reading James is trying to understand exactly how this is true. It is easy to find voices that will appeal to this passage. Don't just be a hearer, be a doer. And then they're going to put in front of you whatever their particular pet project is, and so therefore you ought to be doing this. Be a doer and not just a hearer. So donate money to the building fund, or join the Peace Corps, or become a missionary, or whatever it might be. Now, all of those things are good things to do in the right context. But the issue that we want to confront is, what is it that James has in mind? He's saying that there is something incumbent upon us. There is an obligation that we have to do something in response to this message. And we want to be very clear what kind of an obligation that is. What is it that he's saying we are called upon to do? Because, you know, it is not hard to find people who are going to rush in and suggest to you what it is you ought to be doing, that your faith demands that you do X. Well, what does James have in mind? What does he mean to be a doer of the gospel? I mean, that seems like a strange thing to say in a way. What does it mean to do the gospel? So we're going to try here today in this section and as we continue through the book to be as precise as we can about what it is that James is implying. What is the picture that he's getting at? Now, my fundamental argument is that James is saying something about the nature of believing itself, believing anything, really, that beliefs affect the way we live. So, you know, imagine you're lost deep in the jungle, and a man comes up to you and says, I am the best trail guide that you're going to find anywhere around here. I know every inch of this jungle better than anyone. If you want to get out of this jungle, then you need to follow me. And you say, okay, I'll buy that. I believe your claim that you are the greatest guide in the jungle and you'll get me out of here. So the guide says, okay, well, let's go that way. And you say, well, that doesn't look too good to me. Let's go back this way instead. There comes a point that if you never ever take the advice that the guide is giving you, there comes to be some question as to whether you actually believe that he's the greatest guide in the jungle. I mean, you can say, oh yeah, I buy it, but sooner or later that belief has some implications that you're going to have to confront. Like, even if I don't think it's the right thing to do, maybe I should follow him since I believe he knows what he's doing. So I think that's the kind of thing that James is getting at in the book, that Christian faith is not an empty claim to believe this gospel, but it is an actual embracing of the gospel message and saying, this is not true, this is true, and therefore life looks different to me. James is not saying, as I want to emphasize over and over as we go through, that our works must earn our acceptance before God. He's not denying that we as Christians still have moral failures in our lives. He's not saying that somehow now that I'm a Christian, I have to prove I'm a Christian by a total absence of sin in my life or anything like that. God accepts us in spite of our evil works, and that's as true today as it was the day I believed. But James is saying that believing the gospel is different than not believing the gospel. That believing something, really embracing it as true, is going to involve my entire life and being. It can't help it, or else I haven't really believed it. Someone who believes the gospel is going to act as if the gospel is true, and in particular, trials are going to confront us with these choices and teach us to act in keeping with our faith. Now, our goal, then, as we go through James, is to try to understand the various ways that he sees this to be true. I recognize that as we're going along, sometimes we have to speak sort of generally and abstractly, and then sometimes James brings it down to a specific issue where we can see how that might be true. But our goal is to try to see specifically what is he saying is the logical relationship between the faith that the Christian embraces and the life that I live. Okay, so he continues on then. We don't want to delude ourselves. We need to be a doer of this word and not just a hearer. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks in a mirror at the face he was born with. For he looks at himself and walks away and immediately forgets what he is like. Here we have another one of those real life analogies that James loves to use. I don't know why. I guess everyone in the Bible does this, but James seems to do it a lot. It's just striking how many analogies he likes to set up. Almost every point he makes, he comes up with some analogy to illustrate it. But maybe this analogy is not quite as simple to see what he's saying as some of them. I think it is ultimately, but you have to stop and think about it for a minute. We have to start by thinking about how we use a mirror. Because I think here he's not saying that there's anything wrong with this. This is the way we, in fact, use mirrors. It's just that we shouldn't use the gospel the way we use a mirror, I think is what he's saying. I have a mirror. Why do I go to the mirror? I go to it to look, see what I look like. I go, you know, straighten up and, you know, I'll get something on my teeth and all that stuff and say, okay, yeah, that's presentable. That's fine. And then I walk away. There would be something really wrong if I spent the whole day standing in front of the mirror looking at myself. There would be something bad about that. That's not what a mirror is for. I'm supposed to take a quick look, say that's fine, and then I walk away. And in fact, when I walk away, I think he's right. It is the normal thing, is what happens to us. I then forget what I saw in the mirror. I don't spend all day thinking about, yes, you know, I have a beard, and yes, my eyes are brown, and that's, I mean, I don't think about that stuff. I'm not supposed to. I go out and live my life. The mirror is a quick little touch up, let's look, and then leave. That's what a mirror is for. But I think what James is suggesting here is that that's not what the gospel is supposed to be. It's not supposed to work like a mirror. It does work like a mirror in the sense that it's something that I look at to see what sort of person I am. That's true. Just as I look in the mirror to say, what do I look like? When I confront the gospel, I'm thinking about the question, what am I like? What am I about? But the problem is that many of James' readers are using it the way they use a mirror. They look at it and they say, okay, yeah, I'm a Christian. Yeah, I got my Christian tie, I got my Christian part in my hair, and all of that stuff, great. And then they walk off and they forget what they look like. And they go off and they live their life as if they weren't the sort of person that they just saw in the mirror when they were looking at the gospel. On Sunday, they hear the gospel and say, that's great, fine, yeah, that's, we're Christians, great. And then you walk away and forget it and you go and live your real life. So I think what we should expect that James is about to do is to finish his analogy by saying that we should respond to the word of truth, the gospel, differently than the way we use a mirror. If we are just a hearer and not a doer, then we're using the gospel the way we all use a mirror. We take a quick look and then we walk away from it and forget it. But what we ought to do instead is to remain. The gospel is the sort of mirror that I'm supposed to stand in front of all day, thinking about, what does it say? What sort of a person am I? What sort of a person am I going to be? And thus, ultimately, I do what it says. That's what we should expect James to do as he finishes up his thought. And that is what he's going to do, but he says it in a puzzling way because he switches his terms, and it can be a little confusing here. What he says is, having talked about the one who's like the man looking in the mirror, he says, but one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and remains, not having become a forgetful hearer, but one who does a work, this man shall be blessed in what he does. So, on the one hand, we see just what we would expect. The contrast is looking in a mirror, walking away from it, and forgetting all about it, versus looking at something and remaining, abiding with it, hanging in there with it, examining it carefully, and ultimately looking at myself in the light of that thing. That's what the gospel is supposed to be to me. The surprising thing, though, is that he doesn't call it the gospel, and he doesn't use the language, the word of truth, that he was just using up above. He calls it the perfect law of liberty, which is a little bit strange and a little bit challenging to understand. So I want to take a few minutes and talk about that. There are at least, I think, three important points that we want to make about this phrase. And this is kind of the key phrase in our passage today, this idea of the perfect law, the law of liberty. First of all, although James calls it a law, I'm convinced that he is in fact referring to the gospel. Now, some commentators see this differently, especially because of the perennial problem of trying to figure out how do we relate what James says about how we're justified by works with Paul saying that we're justified by faith and not by works of the law. Some people would like to see James as actually proposing a different way of looking at things than Paul, and that here in this book he's just talking about our need to obey the law. We don't just need to believe in Jesus, we need to put up and do what we're told and keep the law. Well, I think in context it's clear that that's not what James is getting at. Remember, there's a flow to this, and this perfect law of liberty is standing in the place where the word of truth, the implanted word, was just a few verses back. James has been saying that as followers of Jesus, we have embraced a message, the word of truth, that gives us new birth and saves our souls. But we need to be doers of this word, not like a man who looks in a mirror and then walks away and forgets. We need to look at the perfect law and remain with it, actually acting on what it says. So notice, he starts out saying, I need to do the word of truth. He ends up saying, I need to do the perfect law, the law of liberty. But they're the same thing. It's just a new way of talking about the same thing that he was mentioning earlier. So one of the things that we have to do as we're reading James is we have to get used to his shifting terminology. We tend to pretty much use the phrase the gospel. That's not a phrase he uses. The word of truth, the implanted word, the perfect law, the law of liberty. All of those, I would argue, are ways of talking about the same thing. Now, and when they're talking about the same thing, clearly he's not just talking about the Mosaic law. This is the message that God has given us as Christians, followers of Jesus, the message that brings us new birth, the message that saves our souls. So we're talking about the message of the gospel here. If that's the case, though, then that brings us to our second point. It is very striking that James calls the gospel a law, that he would think to take this message that saves our souls and refer to it as a law is a striking thing to do. And I think he does so because he is saying, I mean, we know he's saying here that the message of salvation, this gospel, calls upon us to do something. There is a kind of obedience that is called upon in response to this gospel. It's not just something you hear and ignore. You actually have to respond to it the way you would respond to any law that says, here is what you must do. Now, should we think that this is strange language for James to be using? The fact is that Paul, the champion of justification by faith, also uses this kind of language. He speaks about his call to call other people to obey the gospel. There he's using the gospel specifically, And yet the language he uses is we need to obey it. So even Paul has this idea that the gospel calls upon me to respond in a certain way. The gospel is good news, but it is good news that must be acted upon. So, yeah, I don't have as good an analogy as James does, but just so we're clear of the kind of picture I have in my mind, this good news comes. I've been living in a prison camp for a long time, and the news comes that our armies have won the war, and they're here to free the prisoners. Well, if you just yawn and say, okay, that's great, great, great news, but I'm taking a nap, don't bother me, I'll just stay here, this is a comfortable cot I've got, then I don't think you could really say that you have understood the good part of the good news. You haven't really gotten what it is that's being proclaimed here. It's a message of liberation, but you have to want to be free in order to respond to it. So there's a sense in which a proclamation of good news also has a certain obligation it imposes. Will you recognize that this is good news? Will you respond to this? Or are you going to blow it off? And I think it's that element that James is getting at here. In a sense, the gospel has a certain element of law. It calls upon me to make the appropriate response. But, on the other hand, and this is the third point then about his phrase, what's even more important is that James qualifies what kind of law this is. It is the perfect law. It is the law of liberty. And these qualifications are very important. I think they're so important that James means to actually contrast the gospel with the Mosaic law. That this is the perfect law, in a way that the Mosaic law was not perfect. This brings liberty in a way that the Mosaic law did not. And of course, Paul says exactly these sorts of things himself. The word of truth, the gospel, is the perfect law. It is the law that has become everything a law should be. The Mosaic law was not a bad law, but it was not a perfect law. It was a step along the way, but God had not brought things to the place where he finally intended them to be. The gospel is the law that is finally the perfect expression of what my obligation is before God. It's what God was leading up to from the beginning. And then the word of the gospel, the word of truth, is a law of liberty. This is a very striking phrase. It is a law that brings freedom. By its very nature, a law puts me under obligation. If we are under a law, then we must do what that law says. And that is true of the gospel as well. I have an obligation. There is a response that I ought to, that I should make. But in another sense, this law releases me as well. It brings freedom. Now, James doesn't explain this phrase, but I suspect that this had already become a phrase that people were using in respect to the gospel. And if I ask myself the question, what's the idea behind it? Where did he get this idea that the message, the word of truth, the message that Jesus brought is a message that brings freedom? Well, it seems to me that I see two important and related ideas in the teaching of the New Testament that may be informing what James has in mind here. As sinners, we are pictured in the New Testament as being under bondage. In two ways. First, we are trapped under the condemnation of the law. I have an obligation to live in accordance with God's holy and righteous commandments. And I don't mean like not eating pork and that sort of thing. I'm talking about the fundamental moral will of God. I have an obligation to love God with all my heart and to love my neighbor as myself. And I have failed in that obligation. And so I'm trapped. I am under this law and I stand condemned.
because I cannot fulfill its requirements. Secondly, then, I am trapped in my own sinfulness. I'm an evil person, and I can't really solve the problem. However much I try, I can't reach into my own heart and really do anything about the sort of person that I am. These two kinds of bondage, as I would understand it, at this point in New Testament theology, are related. That is, only God can free us from our sinfulness. The problem of my sinfulness is not something that I can solve. I need the help of my Creator. But the problem is that we all are under God's wrath. We are guilty before God. Why should God reach out and solve the terrible problem of evil in my life when I have earned nothing but His rejection? I don't deserve that sort of kindness. We have rejected a holy and righteous God, and by rights, God should condemn us, not save us from ourselves. So, I stand under the burden of the law's condemnation, and I stand under the burden of my own corruption, and those two things are related, and I can't get myself out from under either of them. The New Testament picture, then, is the gospel brings freedom by releasing us from both of those kinds of bondage. We are no longer under obligation to the law. Christ's death on the cross has brought us mercy. He has offered His life before God, and God has accepted His life as an offering on our behalf. Now, when you look at our lives now, are we keeping God's law and are we worthy of blessing? No. There's not a one of us here today that if you were to look at the way I'm living my life right now, and you say, okay, that's good enough for God to be merciful and grant me blessing. No, even as believers, we're still not in a spot where I could earn my salvation through the way I'm living. But God accepts us anyway. I am free. I can look at the reality of sin in my life and yet, in fact, recognize I am not under the condemnation of the law. I am free from the law and its condemnation. Therefore, I am standing in the favor of God. God looks at me not with wrath, but with acceptance. And because of that, then, He has the freedom to go to work on solving the other problem that I have, my own corruption, that I can't do anything about either. Remember that Jesus said, if we abide in His Word, we shall know the truth, and the truth will set us free. And the kind of freedom He was talking about, He said, is freedom from our slavery to sin. The one who sins is a slave of sin. But if I make you free, you will be free indeed. So it seems to me that one or both of these themes are good candidates for what it is that James has in mind when he calls this a law of liberty. The old law could not free me from my own guilt, nor could it rescue me from my own sinfulness. But the new law, the gospel, is a law of freedom. I am free from condemnation and will one day be completely free from my own inner corruption. Now, do we have to vote? Is it one or the other of those, or could it be both? Just sort of a comprehensive idea of the freedom that the gospel brings. I suppose right now if I had to vote, I would say that probably both of them are kind of in view. As we will see, James refers to the law of liberty a little farther down the line, and in that context, he's talking about mercy. So I think you could say that there's just the little bit of a hint that he might, at least in this phrase, include the idea freedom from condemnation, freedom from the burden of being under the law. But given that Jesus' teaching was very clear about our ultimate freedom from our own slavery to our sin, I suspect that he probably has the whole picture in mind. But either way, you notice what's at stake here is that the gospel is a law, but it is a law that brings liberty. It frees me. It is something that I must respond to, but in responding to it, I find freedom. Not an obligation that binds me and ties me up and makes me a slave, but an obligation that brings me freedom. Now, we have a big issue to address here. This is this question of works. He says you have to do this law. I mean, that's an important phrase, the perfect law of liberty, and I think that's kind of a key phrase for us today, but we still have to deal with this question. So what does it mean to do this perfect law? What does that look like? Well, we're going to be seeing that more and more as we go through the book. There's a certain amount of repetition that happens here because this theme keeps coming up over and over again. But let me say a few things about it here. We're not getting into too many specifics in this section, but still I have something I want to say. From my perspective, the good news, the gospel, is a story. It tells me what God is up to in the world, what my life is about, and most particularly, it tells me what the problem is, and it tells me what the real solution is. Good news involves a problem and a solution, and then requires a response. The story tells me, here's the problem, here's the solution, now what am I going to do? As sinful human beings, we start out with a very strong inclination to embrace the wrong picture of what our problem is and what the answer to our problem is. Now, I mean, you can fill in the details for yourself in your own life. What different ways have you bought the wrong picture of what your problem is and what the solution would be? But maybe we think our problem is that we don't have financial security, or we're not as happy as people seem to be in the movies, or in toothpaste commercials especially. Have you ever noticed, like, toothpaste makes people ecstatically happy in commercials? I mean, I don't think I've ever been as happy as those people are for anything in my whole life as they are about their toothpaste. That's amazing. Okay, maybe we think our problem is that we're not living in a constant state of sexual ecstasy. Nobody thinks our lives are as important as Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie's lives are. I mean, obviously the magazines are not filled with stories of my marriage or any of that kind of stuff. So somehow I'm missing out. Somehow my problem is there is a fulfillment that life has to offer, and I'm not finding it. And so that being the case, we have the wrong picture of what the solution might be. I know what I need. I need more money. I need to be famous. I need to have an important job. I need to have a trophy wife or a trophy husband or whatever it might be that's going to bring me this fulfillment that I feel is lacking. And then having this picture of the problem and having that picture of the solution, we then respond to that. We think, okay, so now I know what I need to do. I need to take those opportunities that come along to find that fulfillment I'm looking for, no matter what the cost might be. I mean, after all, in the end, you have to look out for number one. Well, the gospel tells us a different story. We have a different problem and a different solution. Our basic problem is that we are evil people. Because of our evil rejection of our Creator, we are under God's wrath. We have been kicked out of the garden, denied access to the tree of life, so we're going to die. I can't keep this life. It's going to go away. Our lives are painful, largely because we hurt ourselves and we hurt each other, because we are sinful, selfish people. And in the end, God is going to judge us and rightly condemn us. And we're going to lose, not just now, but eternally. This is our real problem, according to the gospel. That's what the problem is. And the gospel is good news because it tells us of the solution that God is providing. Christ has laid down his life on the cross as an offering to God on our behalf. So we are forgiven in spite of who we are and the evil in our lives. We stand under the acceptance of God. Because of this, we will not die, but we will live forever. On the day of judgment, we will not be condemned, but we will be accepted and blessed. And this means ultimately that life will not be filled with suffering and futility and death, but we will find in God's eternal kingdom a life that is righteous, filled with love, filled with meaning and peace and purpose. That's the problem. That's the solution that's being proposed. And so to believe that story, then, is to have a different sort of response. If that's really what's going on, then what is appropriate for me to do? If the old story is a lie and this new story is in fact the truth of what's going on in my life and in the world around me, then what should I do? Well, what I should do is live in such a way that makes sense, given that that's the way the world really is. So, we can say then that the appropriate response is faith. I should believe this story. And that's what the Bible calls me to do, and that's right. I should believe the story. And in one sense, it is absolutely right to say that all God wants us to do is to have faith. Believe this story that we've been told. But in another sense, we must recognize that a response of faith must involve our entire lives. First of all, we must abandon the old picture of our problem. It was a lie. It's not true. I mean, that picture of what my problem is and what the solution is so out of whack that if I follow it, I'm going to lose everything. If I end up pursuing what the world tells me are the answers to my problems, in the end, I will not have any answers to any of my problems. I will have nothing. I will have lost it all. And then if we were wrong about our real problems and the real solution, then we were wrong in our response. What we were pursuing, what we were thinking, what we were valuing, that was the wrong stuff. Instead, we now believe a new story. Now, it doesn't change the fact that I live in this world and I have to eat, and it's better to have food than not to have food, and it is nice to have security rather than uncertainty and all of those things. Those things have a certain value. But in this new story, they take their place below more important and fundamental issues. Now I know what my essential problems are. That I could, in fact, lose all of my possessions. I could lose the favor of every human being in the world. Everybody is against me. And I could lose my life. And Jesus' perspective is, I haven't lost anything. I mean, now that's a strong statement to make. In the end, I really haven't lost anything, because if I have put my trust in God, all of that will be mine. Security, acceptance, love, favor, blessing, life, all of that will be mine if God's on my side. If this is true, if this story is true, then it only makes sense that I would respond to the things in my life differently, because the world is different than what I used to think it was. There are many, many, many ways that could be expressed. I don't know if any of you remember, but a key event in the history of the thinking around this place was Jack's paper that he wrote many, many years ago called The Anatomy of Sainthood. And he had a list of, I think it was like 21 different ways you could describe what a believer would look like, that the Bible, from the Bible. And of course, things being the way they are, I argued with him and said he didn't have it right, and had to be convinced ultimately, and now I'm convinced. So, but there's still lots of other things that Jack's wrong about. I just want to be straight about that. But the key idea there was, in the one sense, it's perfectly accurate to say all that God is calling us to do is believe the gospel. But in another sense, you could say that in believing the gospel, I am called upon then to believe that I'm a sinner, to forgive other people who are sinners like I am, to love God, we can describe all of the different things that are implications of being a believer that I must confront in real life. We've already seen one example of James, one of the big themes in the letter, where James talks about the issue of money, of the rich and the poor. To have faith to believe the gospel means that we no longer believe that money can solve our basic problem in life. What we really need is the acceptance of God and life in the kingdom of God. That's where the real wealth is to be found. So, you could have $1 billion and you couldn't buy the blessing that God has in store for his people. If you have $1 billion, someday you're going to have no dollars, and then what are you going to do? James' readers have been living, some of them, as if the old story were true and not the new one. And what we see is they say they believe the gospel on the one hand, and yet they suck up to people who have a lot of money, and they treat people who don't have any money like dirt. Why? Because people who have a lot of money can give me something I want, and people who don't have a lot of money can't. So why would I want to be interested in them? Now, again, James is not saying we have to prove how righteous we are. There's no question but that I will find that I don't always treat people the way they deserve to be treated. And I will wrestle with my own selfishness in many ways. But if I have actually embraced a picture of life where I feel no need to repent over my lusting after the rich and my hatred of the poor, I don't feel embarrassed by the fact that I'm running after money because, after all, money is what makes the world go round, then I believe the old story, not the new one. Well, no matter what I say about how I'm a Christian, I believe the old story and not the new one. And that's what James is getting at, I think. He's going to go on then to spell that out a little bit, and it's going to lead us into what we'll talk about next week. But he says, if anyone thinks himself to be religious and yet does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. I just have a quick thing to say about this because this theme is, he's going to explore this more later on. First of all, don't be thrown off by the word religious. If many of you may be like me, thinking of yourselves as not being particularly religious people. By that, I mean, you know, I'm not high church. I don't go for liturgy and that sort of thing. That's not what he has in mind here. It's like he's saying, if anyone calls himself a Christian or something like that. I mean, to be religious is just to embrace this religion and its view of life. One of the themes that James talks about a lot later in the letter is the idea that what we say, how we use our tongues, is an expression of our values and what we ultimately believe. Obviously, in one sense, we can use our tongues to lie. I can say, oh yes, I believe I'm a Christian, when in fact it's not a reality. But James is right in saying that in another way, the way I use my mouth is a very, very good indication of what I'm about. The way I talk to people. The things that I value. And we'll explore that later on when he says that. But all he's saying here is, look, don't tell me that you consider yourself a Christian, and yet everything that's coming out of your mouth shows me that you believe that old story. You're set on these things as being valuable, and you really don't have any place for the gospel in your actual practical day-to-day existence. That religion is worthless. That kind of religion isn't going to get you anywhere. This is the kind of thing that you actually have to look at it and say, oh yeah, that's true. What am I going to do? If you're claiming to believe the gospel and yet your speech shows that you have no room in your life for the implications of the gospel, then you're kidding yourself. That's what he's saying, I think. And this idea of the tongue, we'll talk about that later. Let me just look at his wrapping up this section. He says, this is pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father, to visit orphans and widows in their time of trouble and to keep oneself unstained by the world. Okay, now, I'm sure you're aware the debates that have gone on in the church about what people call the social gospel and that kind of thing. Some who would argue that so that people have something to eat. And this verse is often used as evidence that that's in fact the case. Look, this is what undefiled religion is. to visit widows and orphans in their time of trouble. Well, in the context of James, I hope you can see how this makes sense from what it is he's been saying. Many of James' readers still believe the old story, that their real problem is that they're not rich. The very next thing James is going to talk about in chapter 2 is this classic picture of the rich man comes into the synagogue and they treat him well, and the poor man comes into the synagogue and they say, you know, go sit in the corner. We don't want to be bothered with you. They treat poor people like dirt because they don't think of them as important, because they have no wealth or status, and so they have nothing to offer. Why should they be of interest to me? Well, that is exactly the situation that the widows and orphans are in James' time especially. In this culture, women and children derive their status and protection from the man of the house. Widows and orphans were socially the lowest people on the rung of society, of the ladder of society. I mean, these are the people that they don't really count. There's a reason why Jesus tells a parable about a widow who goes to a judge looking for justice. I mean, the problem is that widow is not the sort of person that's likely to be interesting to a corrupt judge. Well, James is saying that, look, don't tell me that you're a Christian, that you believe this gospel stuff, if when you see those who are in trouble, who have nothing of intrinsic value to offer you in terms of making you more wealthy or giving you more status or something like that, and yet you have no interest in them, don't try to tell me that your religion means anything. True religion is the sort, and he gives two qualifications. It wouldn't be concerned with the status of the person who's in trouble. It would be concerned instead with the fact that they were in trouble. And secondly, true religion keeps itself unstained by the world. In other words, the world around us is going the wrong way. It's telling the wrong story. True faith is the faith that looks at the world with suspicion and says, no, you know, the story they're telling me is a lie. That's not going to get me anywhere. I don't want it on me. That's not what my life is about. So this is just a hint of the kind of thing that James has in mind when he talks about the connection between what we believe and what we do. Someone among us who has little in terms of status or position in the community or whatever, if we're not willing to recognize their value to us as certainly as human beings, but even especially as fellow believers, then we're not really living out the story that the gospel is telling. We just haven't gotten it yet. We haven't understood what our problem is, what their problem is, or what the whole story is about. Okay. Well, on the question of faith and works, James has a lot more to say about that. So I don't, in my conclusion here, I don't really want to go any more into the implications of that, because we have a lot more to say about that as we go along. I just want to make one brief comment about this idea of the gospel, this word of truth, being the perfect law of liberty. It seems to me that this really captures a tension that's inherent in the gospel that seems very profound to me, one that I've wrestled with myself a lot. On the one hand, the gospel is like a law in that we must choose to listen to this story and believe it. It puts me under an incredible burden of obligation. I have to take this on. I have to decide whether it's true or not. I can't blow it off. If I blow it off, I am deciding against it. I have to decide for it. And that's a burden in a sense. I am under obligation to take this message and embrace it. And yet, on the other hand, it is a law of liberty. The fact is that what I'm being asked to do is merely believe and accept that God is going to graciously overlook my many flaws and give me an unimaginable perfection of life that I don't deserve. I can't make myself deserve God's favor. When I look at my life, I'm always going to feel like I don't measure up. But it doesn't matter. because God has forgiven me graciously, generously, freely. That's freedom. I look at myself and say, it's okay. It's okay. And likewise, when I look at myself and feel frustrated with my struggles over many years and the recognition that I am still not what I ought to be as a human being, I can have hope because I am not responsible for cleaning up my act ultimately. God has committed himself to freeing me from my own corruption. So I am free from obligation. I am a sinner, but I am free from condemnation. And I am a sinner, but I am free from my own sinfulness ultimately. It will not tie me down. I'm still wrestling with it now, but in the end it will lose because God is freeing me from it. So I have a deep obligation to believe the gospel, and yet under that gospel I have an incredibly liberating sense of having been freed from my deepest problems. I think Jesus captures the same tension when he talks about how we should take his yoke upon us because his yoke is easy and his burden is light. It's that same sort of ironic tension. You put the yoke on an animal and that's a limitation, that's a burden. I'm going to put the yoke on you. You have to submit to this yoke. You can't go anywhere you want. You're tied here with this thing. And in a sense, being a disciple of Jesus is a great burden and restriction. I have to embrace this. I have to take it seriously. I have to reject one way of looking at life and embrace another one. And I am obligated to do so. But in the end, that yoke is liberating. It brings me freedom. If I do not accept the yoke, I have an illusion of freedom, and in fact, I am in chains. If I accept the yoke, then even though I am restricting myself in some way, I'm really finding true liberty. Well, well, well. It's very late. I'm sorry about that. Not that I haven't done it before. I will, if anyone has one burning question or comment, we could take it, but otherwise we should probably quit.